Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. A MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tincata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tincata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tincata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tincata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tincata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TincataFabrics.com.
Welcome to Fire Service Court Radio. My name is Brad Pinsky, and I'm your host on today's annual FDIC edition. With me today, we have Chip Comstock, John Murphy, the esteemed Honorable Justice Dave Dodson joining us today. We are missing Kurt Verone, but hello to Kurt. I'm missing my voice, apparently, because FDIC is crazy this year already. And today, what we want to do is we want to do a little bit. We always do kind of the year in review a little and then bring in today's topic. And it works perfectly because health and safety is a legal issue when you prevent the problems, right? You prevent the lawsuits. So we're going to talk a little health and safety. And, you know, every week, I get a chance to do another video show with Kurt Verone and talk about the week's legal issues. And the recurring theme seems always to be discrimination, whether it's sex, race. I don't know if any of us have seen any more topics, more common a topic than discrimination. Have you?
Well, as we've talked before, police officers get sued from the external forces. They get sued from the public for excessive force, et cetera. Within the fire service, we sue each other. That's where our lawsuits, they're not operational lawsuits. They're the everyday relationships. And that's where we get ourselves in trouble.
And I think a lot of it comes just because people want it to be swept under the rug and they're afraid to confront, you know, the accuser or the work with the victim. And then they're, you know, you're all about the policy. And the policies are absent in a lot of the departments when you go in and do the investigations. Say, where's your policy against harassment, bullying? And they say, well, we don't have any. And so what happens is a lot of these things will slip into the cracks and there's no real policy to administer. And the rank and file don't understand what it looks like, what it feels like, you know. And so, and then the management is pretty much a non-player in it until they retain outside counsel and all of a sudden, bam.
And I think we talk a good game. When we transition to safety, I'll ask this question too. But I think we talk about, oh, we're accepting of everybody and we're there for everybody in the fire service and we're a community and a brother and a sisterhood. But I don't know that we really mean it, right? When these things are constantly happening, discrimination and retaliation and sexual harassment and bullying of our own people, by our own people, I'm curious if we're really embracing that, you know, that part of the fire service. And it's the same thing with safety. And now we'll kind of transition.
Well, I was going to say, in transition to that point, I think a lot of times it comes down to, do we have policies? Are we training our people on them? Are we enforcing them? You know, how familiar are they or are we with them? And that's, it's a breakdown at different levels. And when we have multiple breakdowns, that's when we usually end up having lawsuits or death. So with that,
right. And look, so one of the things we've seen a lot, and I want to turn a little bit over to Dave and bring Dave in. One of the things we've seen a lot in the weekly lawsuits and verdicts are about things that are happening in the firehouse, right? So not just discrimination, but one of the things we've seen is OSHA in Illinois recently handed out a huge series of fines for as a result of the death of a firefighter in what looks like, if you look at the picture, a single story house, but apparently there was a basement, and falls through, which is unfortunately not uncommon. But the fire department was cited for so many different aspects and violations of our fire brigade standard, of the safety laws. And some of them, for example, one of them was failure to train adequately for rescue, accountability, communication, right, the standards. But the failure to train one is one to me that I thought was really interesting, because that's a systemic problem, if that's true. That's right. Bad communication, I could see how that happens, but failure to train. So here's what we want to talk about. So today, in the legal world, as we said, if we can prevent problems, right, through some systematic program, we can prevent lawsuits. And we've got to create a culture change. That's kind of why I started with the sexual harassment discrimination. We got to start with the culture change. And it seems like we're still not there on the safety side. So introducing it for anyone who doesn't know Dave Dodson, the creator of Reading Smoke and The Art of Reading Buildings. But what some people may not know about Dave is your commitment to the, I'm going to get the name of the association wrong, but it's the National Safety Officers.
Fire Department Safety Officers Association.
And you've been involved with that for so many decades.
Charter member.
So let's talk about health and safety, because we're not talking about it enough. Let me ask you, has the fire world truly embraced health and safety?
Loaded question. First of all, thank you so much for the invitation to be here. I really appreciate that, and an opportunity to talk about this issue. Safety was a very popular word in the early 90s, and it was a direct result of 1500 being issued and the work that Alan Brunicini did with the 1500 document. Now, that work was done in the mid 80s, but it wasn't until about 1990 that people really kind of started waking up and says, whoa, this document is holding our feet to the fire as to what is safe behaviors and not, and what kinds of things should a fire department have in place. And dare I say, the 1500 compliant checklists that were part of that document probably got a lot of fire departments steered in the right direction for being more safe. And there's probably countless lives that were saved just because fire departments had the wherewithal to implement the policies in 1500. Now, a lot of the policies in 1500 were controversial.
Such as?
Open cabs were going away. Riding on the outside of a vehicle went away.
Yeah, those took lawsuits, right? Where someone had to be decapitated to finally end that.
Right. Mandatory seat belts. Now it's 3-point and all positions, so on and so forth. And, of course, the gear and the care and maintenance of gear has spawned a change the industry upside down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're still seeing little bits of that with contamination reduction and cancer prevention. So we're still working hard at the NFPA level on those. But to answer your question, are we really safer and more healthy than before? I just think, to answer that question, the work may never be done.
It's a fair answer. You know, one of the things that I years ago, I got to speak at the Safety Officers Conference, I think that was in Arizona that year. And I got into a lot of trouble because I said, I think we preach a good game, but I don't think we really believe in safety. And so I brought up these slides of newspaper articles, freak accident, freak accident, freak accident, freak accident. And every year it's freak accident. This one was about the cross lays not being covered and the hoses fly off and killed a 4-year-old on a bicycle, killed an old man, killed a, right? Because the LDH is falling off, or the cross lays are falling off. Well, it's just netted. And I'm like, this is just netting. Why won't we just put netting? And it's an NFPA standard, right? But we keep having these freak accidents, and I'm like, it's just netting. And yet the fire service just won't put the damn netting over your crosslays. I mean, the trucks come that way now, but we take it off. Why? Because it takes another second to undo it, you know, or whatever. And we keep having these freak accidents. So I'm wondering, you know, I just don't feel like we're really as safe as we'd like to preach.
Another issue I think at play here too is general statements for all of the fire service versus what is NFPA really trying to do. NFPA is supposed to be the technical committees that write these standards to prevent the lawsuits, to prevent the injuries and deaths, so on and so forth. Everybody that sits on that committee is supposed to represent some kind of facet of the fire service, so it's inclusive of everybody in the fire service. And the people that are on those committees, and I represent the Safety Officers Association on the 1500 committee, they're all dedicated and they all do their homework and all that kind of thing. And that focus, I don't think is necessarily shared as a general statement around everybody. As a matter of fact, I think there's more people that when they hear I'm on an NFPA committee, they almost roll their eyes. Okay, they're trying to control us. They're trying to change the way we do things, so on and so forth, which is true. That's what we want to do.
That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. Right. But it becomes this challenge for a fire department to meet all the requirements of these NFPA standards. And it requires money, it requires resources, and it usually leads to discourse because some people just don't want to change. They have their system in place. They don't want it upset.
Right.
So and so forth. And almost to your opening topic, it's now becoming almost popular to be intolerant.
You know,
in our fire stations.
And
NFPA becomes one of those tools that people complain about, or hey, we don't meet the standard, or you know, or whatever. It becomes a leverage tool of sorts.
I know in Washington State, they've incorporated the 1500 standard into the Washington Administrative Code. So it's a blanket safety standard for all departments in the state of Washington.
Same in Ohio.
Yeah, and it seems to be seamless. Like people understand that it's there. And they probably, you know, when the department incorporates some of these safety standards, they don't really understand the origin of it, understanding that it's our law, right? You don't have to adopt it individually. And so it just becomes, you know, sort of meet and exceed, you know, so we have the base standard, you know, how can we make it better? You know, how can we provide that safety net for firefighters to go home and healthy? And I know that I just did a webinar talking about station design and trying to separate, you know, the apparatus area from the living quarters using, you know, like airlock systems and exhaust capture systems and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Store your bunker clothing, you know, not on the apparatus bay, you know, make sure you wash it. I mean, just, it seems like just simple things, but the simple things cost a lot of money. That's the first thing. And a lot of departments have it. And the second, you know, the engineering and design to, you know, to incorporate a safety nexus into our service, is not always there.
I think the fire service has gotten better at looking at injuries, accidents, death, cancer, right? Clearly the number one topic now, and reacting. But the fire service may have reacted with standards and such, but I don't know that the fire departments and the communities have really started embracing this. And well, let me just say one of the things that was really disappointing, so our viewers know, so OSHA at federal level is going to revise the fire brigade standard, right? And they're trying to make it an NFPA light, almost NFPA 1500 light, but it's a much bigger burden. And about 3-4 months ago, the Fire District Association of New York State sends out a, you need to fight this email. You know, you're not going to be happy. This is bad. I'm like, why are we opposing safety standards? Why, how? We're not saying you can't fight fires, just there's a better way.
First thing that people do, and I think this is part of it, is one is a lack of education and ignorance, right? They just don't understand the standard. They don't understand the reasoning or rationale behind it. We need to do better better job at educating everybody. But even assuming then, a lot of people say it's not worth the cost. We're not gonna, it's cost is a big factor. It's not, but they don't look at what the long-term big picture is. And in Ohio has a standard about physical exams, that, you know, that every firefighter is supposed to go through an annual medical certification, you know, and so people either aren't aware of it, or they say that's too much money. We don't want to do it. Well, if somebody has a line of duty, death, injury that can be shown that they is a result of not having that, there are huge fines behind that. And then I start saying, are you willing to pay that cost that comes right out of your own, you know, pocket, not from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation? And so people are like, I didn't know that was there. And I think that when you look at the cost of suffering, Bobby Halton talked today about, you know, that we leave a lot of suffering and tragedy behind when there's a death or some other injury, and people don't factor in that cost when they're making their short-term decisions on, we're not going to do that. It costs too much. You know, okay, everybody can ride on the backside of the apparatus because we don't want to close our cabs. There's a cost when that accident happens. Well, and I just don't think people can focus on that.
You get pushback from the unions too. And surprisingly, it's because we try to implement a standard for medical physicals on an annual basis. The unions pushed back and said, you're trying to get rid of firefighters because there may be some that have heart disease or hypertension or, you know, all of the common and ordinary diseases, which may not meet the standard of the 1582 standard, right? And so in essence, they say, well, you're going to try to fire us for medical, you know, medical finding. And I'm always like, we're trying to find ways to make you keep you healthy and make sure that you can retire healthy. And this is just one tool in the box for that to occur. And so it took, one of the labor leaders to go, and he was relatively obese, but everything was fine. And the doctor said, well, if you lose 160 pounds, then your life's going to be that much better. So he had some bariatric surgery, which he paid on his own, lost 160 pounds, like a whole person, like you.
Like, right.
Lost a whole Brad.
It's me and a little.
And the guy looks great, you know, and then he can do his job safer. But it set the example for the other labor members to say, well, it's not as threatening, you know, as management bringing these sort of requirements forward, even though there is a standard out there.
It is interesting too, the comment that the unions push back a little. That's probably true at the local level, but I got to tell you, at the national level or international level,
oh, absolutely,
the union has funded almost all of the medical research.
Oh, wow.
That is used to make decisions for what's in 1581, 1582, so on and so forth. They have put a lot of money into the research, because they want to make sure that it's a fair standard, especially when you get into disqualifying firefighters.
Oh, the Category A conditions, yeah.
So they have done all the research, and they bring the experts. They've brought a lot of doctors to our meetings to make the best possible decision that's fair to firefighters. And that's all funded by mostly the union.
Huh. Yeah. I find it's the volunteers that are the pushback. The volunteers just don't want the standard, because I'll give you an example. So Category A condition, right? Absolute exclusion, type 1 diabetes. Yet, you know what I said, you shouldn't allow somebody on blood thinners for crush injuries. I'm like, come on, there's good logic behind that. Why NFPA says you can't be a firefighter with that. And the volunteer world's like, yeah, but we need volunteers. You can't keep, you know, killing the volunteer fire service. And we just, I think it's the volunteers who really don't want a true standard, because we'd start losing volunteers. We'd just rather keep having the 90-year-olds on the fire trucks.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, there's a high attrition of those guys too. So.
Yeah, you know, so we're having it. In my county, there have been, there's a line of duty death right north of us in New York, where I think the funeral's tomorrow. We had just had a chief in our county have a heart attack on scene on the hose line, an older guy, and now the heart attack was a younger guy. But, you know, the question is, could we catch some of these things? If we were more aggressive, would we catch some of this?
Absolutely. You know, that's the thing. Even to me, with the physical examinations, we're going to say we're going to follow the NFPA standards. But for us, we're going to try to work with that person and get them in a position. What we see all the time is high blood pressure, borderline diabetes. Heart conditions that many of them can be treated with or can be resolved through some form of treatment. mitigated through treatment, and have that person actually be a productive member of a department with the less risk on the fire ground. I want to ask Dave, because we were talking a little bit before about the changes in NFPA. There's a whole bunch of things going on with the 1500 standards.
Yeah, the biggest thing coming down the road is the switch to what they're terming, not officially, super standards. So we know, like in the 1500 series, we were responsible for 1500, which was occupational safety and health programs, 1521, which was the safety officer professional qualifications, 1561, which was emergency services, incident management system and command safety. And then the 1580 series, which includes firefighter medical for candidates as well as incumbents, wellness programs, so on and so forth, 1584, which is the rehab standard, all of those. Well, the Standards Council, the big overhead group that manages all the technical committees, all the various ones, they looked at the 1500 catalog, let's say, and they said, you know what, there's way too many documents there. It would probably be more user-friendly if we kind of group some of these together, because in many cases, there's a lot of redundancy from document to document. And that would, it would help eliminate some of the redundancies, get everything on the same page, like even just definitions. One document had a, for the same word, a given definition, but another document has the same word with a different
must
definition.
Be lawyers on the committee.
I'd argue the
opposite.
I'm
really glad they're doing this, but it's been a lot of work, a lot of correlating had to take place. But as it stands right now, we are in the first draft process, which means we have another draft to go, another opportunity for people to look at how the documents are going to come together and comment on those. But as it stands now, 1500, 1521, and 1561 will be one document.
Oh, okay.
So when 1500 came out, we talked earlier about all this, I don't want to say controversy, but certainly discourse through that, the promulgation of that, and everybody's hit with some new things. Do you see with the new standards coming out, the super standard, people's focus again going back to that and saying, oh, you know, what are they trying to do with this new standard? Do you think there'll be, and I'm not asking you to get into the details because those standards haven't been adopted yet, but do you think there'll be a refocus on the 1550 standard? I think it's the new
1550 will be the new document number. And I mean, I'm putting a lot of effort into it as the rest of the committee members are. I hope this brings a little bit more energy, a little bit more resources to meeting the standard. I hope it does open up, because 1500 was always like the mother document, right?
Yeah.
And 1521 for safety officers got very little look. You know, it was such a little niche that it didn't get the attention.
Which is crazy, though, because the not the enforcer, but the overseer of the safety program, right? I mean, I ask people all the time, do you have a health and safety officer? And they're like, we have incident safety. I said, that's not health and safety.
Right.
And I'm like, and they're always saying, well, what is an HSO? What's a health and safety? I'm like, how are we at that point where people don't even know there's a health and safety officer? And I will say, New York State started teaching the health and safety officer course. I got the certification, and now you can't even get the course anymore. They don't teach it. It's not in the catalog. So what's going on?
Well, you know, I guess the thing is, if states have adopted the 1500 standard, right, under their local OSHA.
Many haven't.
But if this is adopted into a single document and states follow the past practice, they may mandate the health and safety officer, you know, all these other issues that have been ignored up till now.
And the same can be said for command. There's still a lot of fire departments out there that don't use a formal incident command system, or the system they have is some kind of hybrid that they've created that doesn't follow the NIMS model or the Bernasini model.
And let's talk about that. because that's a big legal issue. So unfortunately, from my department of Miami Mutual Aid, when two of our firefighters fell through the floor on March 7th of 02, the result of that was a lawsuit. And, you know, I looked at the lawsuit and said, look, you can't, very tough to win on a fire department for, against the fire department for discretionary decisions. And what the appellate court did is brilliant. And I think they're right. They said, yeah, that's true. Except NIMS has four non-discretionary standards. One is incident command. NIMS is federal and state law in every single state. So they said, following NIMS is not discretionary. You will be held liable if you don't follow NIMS. The NIMS standard essentially incorporates, right, the incident command system from 1500 or, so I'm suggesting as a legal issue to departments, NIMS is federal law and your state law, every single state. So if you're not going to follow the incident command system and the standard, I don't care, like New York hasn't adopted NFPA, but for two things. But I would argue that the only standard we have for incident command is NFPA and NIMS, right? Essentially identical. But you better follow them because you'll be charged with freelancing and not, you know, which is what happened in our case, but not following the incident command system, freelancing, not checking in. Is accountability getting wrapped into that?
It's always been part of 1500 accountability system, but the management of an accountability system on an actual incident is the responsibility of the incident commander, and it's very well mapped out in the current 1561, and it'll be part of that 1515 super document.
So that's a huge legal issue for people. I mean, right off the bat, if incident command isn't right, and again, it's federal and state law.
Think about how many line of duty deaths have resulted in some small part anyways of a lack of accountability. And the issue of Illinois that you talked about at the beginning, that they weren't even aware of it, that firefighter was missing right in the basement for an extended period of time.
Until they got to rehab, strangely enough, I think, right?
So that was one of the issues.
And that's not uncommon. We've identified the wrong firefighters, right? Which one? I don't think it was the Hackensack, but there was a auto mall or one where they didn't know that the firefighter was missing. Somebody came out and said, oh, it was me. So they canceled the Mayday and it wasn't that person. Mm-hmm. You know, it accountability is a tough issue and it's obviously a legal issue. It
keeps repeating itself. I mean, think of the absurdness that a fire department lost their safety officer. And nobody knew he was gone.
Oh, Jesus.
The safety officer. And they actually had to respond back to the scene because somebody complained that there's this fire vehicle that's running with the windows partially open, but all the rest of the fire department left and this vehicle is still there. It was the safety officer's duty vehicle that they complained that it's blocking the street. You need to come and get it. That's when they realized the safety officer was gone. Safety officer went into a fire scene where there were some holes in the floor because of renovations and that sort of thing going on, fell into the basement. The carbon monoxide level in the basement was high enough to basically render him unconscious in seconds. And they know this because of the forensics that they did, that kind of thing. And everybody left the scene and he was still there.
You know, and that's a great, you know, issue too, because it would beg the question, if we're really going to talk about that type of thing, is why is he going in at all? Why did he go in alone? Why doesn't he have a CO meter? Why wasn't the building taken care of? Why wasn't it roped off? Right. As well as the accountability. I don't know in the fire services, if we're so good yet about taking accountability for our actions and actions, our lack of education.
That's what lawyers are for.
Yeah, no, but that's true.
I'm serious.
Right.
You know, and I wrote an article years ago called Changing the Fire Service One Lawyer at a Time. And it was a tongue in cheek. But the issue is we either do the change internally. We either embrace NFPA 1550 or we don't. And if we don't,
the lawyers will do it for us. And that's how they close cabs at the National Health and National Safety Officer Conference. One of your longtime speakers was the attorney, right, who had the lawsuit on the decapitation for riding in an open cab or something.
Why are air horns and sirens down in front of the cabs now?
Hearing protection.
Right. But what caused
all the lawsuits.
All the lawsuits from firefighters who had hearing loss.
And the quiet cab standard, right? Our cabs used to be, I mean, the engines right there used to have no sound protection. It was like 95 decibels in the cab.
It's an echo chamber.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I have minor hearing loss. And yeah. So, and they're like, do you do anything with loud noises? I'm like, gee, I can't think of one. You know, I mean, but there have been a ton of those lawsuits. But I agree. And I think it does take lawsuits to get.
It shouldn't, but it does.
Well, I think the other thing too is that we've seen a decrease in actual fire fighting. And so the experience that, you know, unless you're in a large city and you have a huge fire load, you know, you get fires all the time. But if you get out into the, you know, suburban area, the wilderness with volunteers, you know, the frequency of fire is fairly low. So their actual hands-on combat time probably is 2 hours a year. And so supplementing that with some sort of realistic training to substitute that sort of real experience is hard to do. You know, most of the departments aren't that sophisticated. The fire service has a tendency to be fairly tribal.
1403 standards for a live fire and acquired structure is very rigorous. I'm not saying they're too rigorous, but I mean, it's a tough standard to have, you know, three water supply sources and, you know, an extinguishment team to protect the, but NIOSH said many, many years ago when they were looking at, I think, the Lairdsville incident with Alan Baird, they said, you know, we don't have enough live fire experience. And so we need the acquired structures. The problem is it's so dangerous doing that now, especially with lightweight construction.
EPA shuts a lot of that sort of open burning down because of air pollution, you know, quality control. And so you try to substitute that sort of heat and pressure and smoke experience in artificial chambers. And it's not the same.
Fighting a propane fire is just not like fighting a fire.
Training tower they have at our training center in Washington, you know, they use wood and they use all of the sort of the material to create the heat and the smoke.
But you're limited to two pallets.
It's pretty well, you can look at it, go, I know where I'm going to go, as opposed to in a residential structure. It's like, no, I fell through a hole in the floor because they were doing a remodel.
That's why we use sofas, couches too.
Yeah.
I'm kidding, Dave.
And Lairdsville was the couch.
And you know, we're talking about Lairdsville and Arthur Baird and NFPA standards. So what happened to Arthur Baird when they had a line of duty death as a result of
gets convicted for criminally negligent manslaughter, goes to prison for 6 months.
Using an NFPA standard. Right.
Well, and there, what the question was, were you even aware that there was an NFPA standard on this issue? His lawyer, who I think got disbarred the next day for drug trafficking. I mean, he had very bad counsel. But nonetheless, you know, the question there was, were you aware of NFPA? And his answer said no. They're like, well, you conducted a highly dangerous activity and you weren't even aware there was a standard. Didn't matter that he adhered to it. The question was, he didn't even know about it. And based on that, the DA convicts him, sends him to jail, which is very scary for the fire service. The outrage at that time was among fire service people, Chief Tom Watts and a bunch of others, I was just very, it was right. Like, why are we convicting people for doing this stuff? We may be ignorant, but give us, you know, and I don't mean that in a bad way. We may be ignorant of a standard, but help educate us, provide us the training and the funding and all that.
Well, it did put the focus on 1403.
Sure did.
For sure. But it took a death to do it, you know, and a conviction to do it.
And
that's what people pay attention to. And that's the tragic thing. I mean, that's what it takes. Not only that tragedy, and then they bring in the standard that people should have been aware of, and then the lawyers get involved, and whether it's a criminal or civil case, now people wake up because now it means something to them. I don't want to go to jail. Right. I don't want to have to be sued. And so there's a big focus. And for a while, I think we're pretty good about it. 1403, there was a lot of, you know, states have adopted those standards to try to prevent what are clearly preventable deaths. But I think, again, that we just don't do enough in terms of our education. And I'm not sure what the answer to that is.
Well, I think there's a positive side to all this too. And that is how much improvement have been made for instructors. I mean, there is now credentialing for live fire training, and even the credentialing for live fire training is subcategoried into, is it a fixed facility with propane or are you doing acquired structures, et cetera? And to get credentialed, I think is an important step, so we don't lose that valuable training that you can get, especially from acquired structures. Now, you do bring up a good point about EPA. You know, a lot of places just forbid burning anything for training purposes. And of course, now in the West, just about everybody's under a burn ban.
Right.
But it is a very valuable tool that I would hate to see us lose. If for nothing else, it allows you to repeat the behaviors you want firefighters to have you can repeat it in a standard way. You know, they say, you know, what did Alan used to say? He said, wants firefighters that do a standard thing in a standard way. And those live fire training props allow that to happen. And you can correct behaviors in a very controlled way. And of course, being one of those people that ushered in 1403 to my own department, we used acquired structures because we didn't have a burn building.
Mm-hmm.
And we had maybe 5 or 10 a year.
Wow. Wow, yes, which is great used practice.
Until we shut it all down.
Right.
In our state.
And the learning just couldn't be replicated. It was awesome. Now, granted, we were using fuel packages that are no longer allowed under 1403,
right,
but
right.
When we were ushering in the document, those fuel packages were allowed.
Right.
We took advantage of them.
And you truly got to observe fire behavior and, you know, and fire spread and fire growth. It was
and
just
we took away that liability issue by following the document and checklists that are in there.
Right. True. Yeah.
But
true.
One of the big things we're seeing out in the West every year is the West is on fire.
Oh yeah.
So wildland firefighting is a huge issue too. And so I know that they do the arduous pack test to make sure that people can actually do the job. And then the safety standards that are inherent and, you know, falling a tree, running a bulldozer, you know, picking out a line, back burns, you know, helicopter airdrops. And there's a lot of potential for fatalities. And, you know, we've noticed there's been, you know, flashovers and firefighters of the Arizona guys, you know, got caught up in that sort of stuff. And there is several years ago in our state, firefighters got caught. And a couple of them died, even though they deployed their shelters. And the incident commander was put on the hot seat because of his command and control, which may or may not have been up to standards, but it was that sort of evolving large project fires that require some training for the commanders, right? So they arrested him for negligence because it was this, they were down here and the incident happened over here. And so his responsibility was the whole fire, right? And so it sort of put a chill on, you know, do you want to be the incident commander on a large project fire, which for a couple of years, people are going, I don't want anything to do with this. And then they finally resolved the case, you know, didn't incorporate a jail sentence and those sorts of things, but it certainly, you know, brought to light, you know, what are the safety standards now for wildland firefighting? What's the equipment package looking like, you know, because we used to go out in all our structural gear and, you know, have a high heat issue. And now it's all, you know, lightweight stuff and, you know, better gear, I think.
For that's issues. A moving target too. Cause right now some of the behaviors that they're documenting exceed what's in the current books and the appropriate actions for that given intensity. So that's a moving target right now.
Well, it rolls through the communities and burns the whole community down. You know, you're displaced. First of all, you got a mass exodus of people and animals, and then you got, you know, property destruction is just unimaginable, like a whole town sort of wiped out. And that just, it's replicating itself, you know, and you know, you kind of joke about, let's go rake the forest. There was a person that said that once. And, but you know, what they've gotten away from is these sort of controlled burns to prevent the undergrowth and trying to thin it out the areas that are of.
Yeah, there was a lawsuit that was commenced 2 months ago. I think Kurt and I did it on our show, and they were they were doing the back burning, and it accidentally caught where it shouldn't have.
Yeah.
But you know what? Well, I guess one of the things that you mentioned is that they have incident commanders or people who are afraid to take over a role because I don't want to be sued. I don't know that that happens a lot, but we've talked about, you know, does that, is that something that that would prevent people from taking a role of responsibility? And I think people should embrace those roles of responsibility because it can affect change. But the key is, you know, not being ignorant, not sticking your head in the sand and saying, you know, I don't have to worry about that standard. You know, if you're going to take that role responsibility, you'll be fine as long as you do your best to try to keep up with the standards and keep your people safe. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that from a position of ignorance.
And I agree. Don't let the lawyers force you to be the one to do it. Let me switch topics for a second, because, and I don't know whether you know, but I want to ask. So AFFF, right, is one of the biggest lawsuits going on. These plaintiffs firms are bringing on tons of, you know, AFFF firefighter cancer cases. And the other day, there was a suit, which was very interesting, where the property owner is suing the fire department for putting AFFF on his, it was a New Jersey department, for using AFFF and contaminating his property. And normally the property owner would be liable for, you know, something like that. But here he sues the fire department. So my first reaction when I'm reviewing this case is, why is there still an AFFF out there? Like what, and how did AFFF escape for so many decades any safety standard? You know, I'm not sure if that's anything within your, we don't seem to regulate.
I started as an Air Force firefighter. So
okay.
That's the right guy. Oh,
okay.
And I'm not giving out any secrets or anything else, but we used to wash the fire trucks with AFFF.
Oh my God.
We did.
That explains your third leg.
And it's no wonder I have no lungs left. But AFFF, oh gosh, we did pit fires. Like you pour 200 gallons of JP4 jet fuel into a ground pit, not lined anything else. Then you
how torch did that happen? Off.
It was in the name of training.
But I mean, how do we even use the chemical today? Would be, everything we do on the fire truck is regulated, right? And for many years has been, you know, NFPA standard. You couldn't build a fire truck for the last 20 years, right? The 1901 standard, I think. I mean, I forget when that came out, but how does foam escape the fire world?
It's a scientific issue that it's one of those things. There was a delay. People didn't know that it was a carcinogen.
Did we not know? I mean, is this asbestos all over again?
I think they found something that worked that put out fuel fires. And that was the big issue because planes were getting bigger and bigger and they were all becoming jets. And the next thing you know, we have 747s and DC-10s and C-5 Cargo Masters and all these aircraft out there that have thousands of gallons of fuel. And we had no way of putting out those fires. So they were more concerned about, let's find something that we can mix with water and mass apply using these crash trucks, these ARFF vehicles. That became the first scientific need.
Okay.
And once they found something that worked, it was like, crap, this works really well.
Yeah. So did asbestos. I mean, it's, you know, those asbestos blankets.
And then the next data stream that comes along is like somebody says, wait a minute. Especially Air Force firefighters and other firefighters are having high rates of these kinds of cancers. Is there a theme?
Right.
Let's go find the theme. And then we have the water issue pop up because, like I said, hundreds of thousands of gallons of foam mix has been pumped into these fire pits to put out all these practice fires, and it's got to go somewhere. And the next thing you know, it pops up in somebody's groundwater.
Yeah.
And they're like, what is this?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a PFC. Ooh.
It's the Aaron Brockovich movie, right? We've contaminated all the drinking water. Yeah.
And there's Air Force bases all across this country that are having to fight this problem because it was the Air Force base that even municipal fire departments went to get their training because they had the pits. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have all the regulations.
Right.
And they could actually burn. I mean, we had a once a year requirement in Colorado to do a live fire training to keep our ARFF certification at our airport. So if you want to stay certificated, then you have got to show the training records that people have had live fire training. And the only place we could do it was at the Air Force base. And, you know, they got a grant to open it up and all that kind of stuff. But once again, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of gallons of foam mix have been pumped into the ground there.
And the fact that there are still departments carrying AFFF is just beyond me.
The problem is, what do you do with
it? Our DC collected it. They sent a letter out and said, we're collecting it all, and they, you know, arrange for it. They find you, but they...
I wonder how they get rid of it.
I have no idea, right? What do you do?
I don't know.
It's like, what do you do with plutonium? I have no idea. I mean,
pour it down the sewer.
I say we send it to the moon. Just, you know, drop the AFFF on the moon. It can't hurt it.
It'll put it out.
But you know, it's that type of thing that when I saw why is the department using AFFF, it comes back to where we started. We know about issues. These aren't secret issues. So what's happening that we're not following these standards and learning? And, you know, when Goldfeder released firefighter close calls and the secret list, and we finally start talking about the oh shit moments, you know, I feel like the fire service changed a little bit from within rather than the lawyers, but, you know, we changed from within, and it was okay to talk about, boy, I shouldn't do this again. Yet we still have the constant ignorance of freak accidents. And, you know, I go back to, why aren't we covering our damn crosslays? It's just a net, but we don't want to do that because, you know. Okay. So, well, I want to thank everybody. On behalf of Chip Constock, John Murphy, Dave Dodson, and of course, we cannot end without saying hello to our number one biggest fan, my mother, brought to you. So hi, Mom. But we really want to thank you. We look forward to seeing you once a month on Fire Service Court Radio. You can be one of our, I think we're up to 14 billion viewers now, I think, every week. Yeah, it's all of China's watching. In any event, we look forward to seeing you. Please be safe. We hope we don't have to see you in court. Thanks a lot.